Just as we can use the framework that is a body as a grounding awareness for all the rest of our experience. You know, as a framework for being aware of the breath or sensations or thoughts or emotions. There's also a framework that the Buddha laid out in terms of the wisdom of understanding how we can be both happy and free in our lives. We could call it the framework of wisdom, in which we can see all the different aspects and levels of our experience and relate to them in a wise way. It's somewhat interesting that the first step on the Noble Eightfold Path is right understanding. So it's as if the Buddha is starting us in wisdom, and we proceed from there. So there are two aspects of right understanding that I just want to highlight very briefly tonight, and then we can open it for discussion. One level of right understanding which we can explore in our daily lives in a very profound way, yet it's something that is extremely nuanced and subtle, and that is the awareness, practicing the awareness of the motivations behind our actions. You know, it's said in some teachings that everything rests on the tip of motivation. Motivation is the key to understanding how our karma unfolds in our lives. Motivation is the key to seeing what are the causes of suffering for ourselves and others, what are the causes of happiness for ourselves and others. And as you know, I think you probably all know, the Buddha, in a way, made it very simple for us. He described the root motivations of all unwholesome actions as being greed or hatred, aversion or delusion, and the root motivation of all wholesome actions as being the opposite of non-greed or generosity, non-hatred or love, non-delusion or wisdom. It's really interesting to bring this awareness of motivation to the forefront of our practice, of our daily practice, not simply sitting, but our life practice. You know, what is the motivation behind what we do? You know, the various things we do in the course of a day. In a very broad area of investigation, for example, would be to really pay attention to the motivation behind our speech. You know, we speak a lot in the course of a day. Do we stop to consider what's motivating us? You know, is it loving kindness? Is it a feeling of generosity? Is it a feeling of aversion or ill will or annoyance or irritation or delusion? One of my favorite challenges in terms of right speech is refraining from what the Buddha called in Pali sampapalapa. And the translation of sampapalapa is exactly what it sounds like, which is useless talk. You know, it's just sampapalapa. And it's so interesting for me to watch my mind, and just as we engage in social, you know, ordinary social interactions, how often there will be the impulse to say something that is totally useless. And it's really just a way of saying, here I am. And the strength of that impulse has amazed me. Because very often, even when I can see the impulse arise in my mind, you know, say it's just to put out something useless. Even when I'm mindful enough to see the impulse arise in the mind, and maybe the impulse passes, about 5 seconds later it's back again. You know, and then maybe it'll pass. And it's really a toss-up whether it's going to end up being said or not. Yeah. But I love just watching it. I love watching, you know, the strength of our habits and the possibility of really understanding the motivation behind what we're doing, in this case, speech. You know, in that situation, it's really delusion. It's just, you know, it's not particularly aversion, it's not particularly greed. It's just the deluded mind, you know, expressing itself. In one aspect of right speech, which is very simple, but I think if people would practice just this in terms of watching their motivation, the whole world would be transformed. When he said, speak that which brings people together rather than that which divides people. And just imagine if in all of our relationships, we only spoke that which brought people together rather than dividing. But in order to practice that, we need to be aware. We need to be aware before we speak of, okay, what's the motivation? You know, is it really loving kindness of bringing people together? Or is it some kind of, you know, ego manifestation in some strange way, you know, of wanting to separate people or divide people? That's just one example of how we can pay attention to motivation. You know, it's not only speech, it's also in actions of our bodies, what we actually do, you know, physically, in the kinds of thoughts we have and act upon or cultivate. You know, are we cultivating wholesome thoughts in the mind or unwholesome thoughts in the mind? As I mentioned the other day, a phrase that the Buddha used, which has really been impactful for me in just understanding the import of it. And it's such a common sense statement. You know, this is not like a subtle teaching. It's just very obvious, but we overlook it so often. Where he said, you know, that which we frequently think about will become the inclination of our minds. And it just makes sense. If we get into the habit, certain habit patterns of thought, it might be habit patterns of judgment, judging others, judging ourselves. It might be habits of criticism. It might be habits of unworthiness. It might be habits of fear. It might be habits of generosity, of love, you know, of kindness. Whatever we frequently think about, ponder upon, will become the inclination of our minds. We habituate those patterns, and it becomes easier then for them to arise again. But the only way we can transform our lives in a wholesome way is if we become aware of the motivation. If we're not aware of what's arising, then we're simply acting out the habit patterns of our lives. We're acting out our conditioning, a lot of which is wholesome. You know, I think most of us are leading basically skillful lives, but not completely skillful. You know, and I think one of the great gifts of meditation is it helps us cut through self-delusion. You know, I love sitting so much because it's such an honest look at our hearts and minds. It's like we can't help but see what it is that's arising. Ajahn Sumedho, you know, probably most of you are familiar with him, the American monk who's in the Thai forest tradition and helped bring that tradition back to the West. He had a phrase which I found very telling. He said, our task is not to follow the heart, it's to train the heart. You know, and so much in our culture, and especially kind of New Age vocabulary, I don't know, is this still New Age, or are we post-New Age? Maybe New Age is from the 60s, and this is... Anyway. That it's not a question of following our hearts, it's training our hearts. Because there's a lot in our hearts, a lot that's beautiful, but a lot that's not. And so it's not just acting on every impulse that we have, but it's really bringing some discerning wisdom to motivation. You know, and seeing whether the motivation is rooted in the wholesome roots or the unwholesome roots, and then through that awareness, we have the ability to make a choice. You know, we can choose to let the unwholesome ones go, and to actually cultivate and develop and practice the wholesome ones. So this is one aspect of right understanding. And it's really key to leading a happy life. Because as the Buddha said often, we are the heirs of our own actions. We are the heirs of our karma. You know, and the opening verses of the Dhammapada, you know, the collection of short verses, teachings, if we act based on a pure mind, happiness follows us. If we act based on an impure mind, unwholesome motives, unhappiness follows us, suffering follows us. So it's not hard to understand. It's hard to remember, to pay attention in this way, to have this be a framework for how we investigate and examine our lives. So this is one level of right understanding. And it's really the key to living with greater ease, you know, with a greater sense of peace. The other level of right understanding just drops us into a whole other dimension. It doesn't particularly have to do with seeing our motivations and the actions which follow upon them. It has to do with seeing kind of the characteristics of all experience. And somebody once asked Suzuki Roshi, you know, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, he said, I've been listening to your talks for years and I still don't understand anything. Can you please just express the Buddhist teachings in a nutshell? And so Suzuki Roshi thought for a moment and he said, everything changes. That was all. Again, this is something that's not esoteric. This is not some kind of hidden truth. And yet, it's so apparent that we basically have stopped paying attention to it. You know, it's like fish swimming in the water, maybe unaware of the water as the element in which they're living. Everything on every level, every single aspect of our minds, our bodies, the world, is just in a constant state of change, of flux. This is not a mistake. You know, it's just the Dharma. It's the nature of this law. It's like natural law. It's just the science of things. That everything is changing, and changing pretty rapidly when we look very closely. And we think we know this, because conceptually it's so easy to understand. It's not difficult. And yet if we really understood, if we really were living our lives, seeing it in our lives, we wouldn't be grasping, we wouldn't be clinging at things. Because if we cling to that which is changing, we suffer. It's so simple. If we are clinging to youth, we suffer as we age. If we're grasping at health, we suffer when we're ill. if we're clinging to a person staying a certain way, we suffer when they change. If we're clinging to our hair, we suffer when we lose it. And so on. So again, what's so striking about the teachings is that they're so easily, at least these aspects of them, are so easily understood. But somehow we get so busy in our lives and we get so carried on the forward momentum, you know, of our activities, that we stop attending to these basic truths, you know, which if we were more aware of them, we would live much more harmonious lives. We would be in harmony with nature, in harmony with the Dharma, with harmony with how things are happening. It might be an interesting experiment just to take as a challenge sometimes. I don't know, you might do it for an hour or a half a day or a day, whatever. You know, whatever appeals to you. Just having the intention for that period of time to notice how things are changing. You know, the changing of the body, the changing of the breath, the changing of all the sounds that are happening, the changing of the thoughts that are going through the mind, the changing of our mind states, our feelings. Just to notice the change. And I think it would be striking in doing that to see how often we don't notice it. You know, how often we're just caught up in the story of our lives. This morning, Rodney and Ellen took me to the IMAX to see the Hubble telescope film. And it really was quite extraordinary. You know, and kind of, especially with the 3D IMAX, you know, and you're just kind of in outer space and all the work they were doing on the telescope and, you know, the repair of it over the years, and also, you know, the view of outer space and there are 100 billion stars in our galaxy and 100 billion galaxies, and I mean, it's, you know, and to have kind of that visual of it was just so amazing. And what struck me was, from that perspective, what we get so worked up about. You know, we are so over-involved in our stories, given the magnitude of the universe. But we forget, you know, we just forget, and we do get caught up. And this is the power of mindfulness. So we use this experience, you know, our everyday lived experience, to notice and to practice noticing the changing nature of things, of how grasping is the cause of suffering in our lives. And it leads us to that aspect of the teachings which is not so intuitive, in fact, which is counterintuitive, and that is the whole teaching on selflessness. You know, that experience does not actually refer back to a self. And that this felt sense of self, which is very deeply conditioned, is arising in those moments when we are identifying with our experience. It's not that the self is a something that's there, but rather the felt sense of it happens when we identify with thoughts. And there's identification with a feeling, with an emotion. I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm happy, I'm thinking, I'm hearing, I'm seeing. You know, our whole language and our whole life is like refers back to this sense of self. And yet through the practice of mindfulness and through the doorway of seeing the impermanence of things, we begin to see that everything is just arising and passing on its own. Everything is expressing its own nature. Anger angers, love loves. Thoughts are the thinker, that they don't belong to anybody. But this is not to say that on the conventional level, we throw out the concept. We do, we use it. You know, we relate as self and other. And so this was expressed very well by one Tibetan teacher when somebody asked him, you know, does the self exist? Is the self real? And the teacher said, yes, it is real, but not really real. And so somehow we need to kind of get our arms around that one. You know, so we are living embodied in our lives, relating as one self to another, and with all that entails, the conventional level of reality, but we also go deeper and see that on another level, it's not really real. So maybe I'll just leave it at that. Do you have any questions, or either about the meditation, that guided meditation, whether it offered any kind of new perspective in your sitting, or things I've mentioned just now, or other questions about your practice? Of working with?
Not identification of thoughts, emotions, bodies, what you were just
reading. Yeah. You know, that it's the very simplest access point to beginning to get some sense of the selfless nature, we could say the non-personal nature of experience, is through refining our perception of change. Because that's more obvious. You know, as I said, the selfless aspect in that part of the teaching, that's the most difficult, that's the most puzzling. I mean, because our whole world is constructed around this notion of self. But impermanence is something that we both can understand easily conceptually, and it's not that difficult to see in experience. What happens in meditation, and this is part of the deepening of practice, and this comes from the strengthening of mindfulness, is that we refine our perception of change. And so it's something I call NPMs, which are noticings per minute. You know, in the beginning, maybe our mindfulness is picking up, I don't know, 10 or 15. You know, separate arisings and passings in a minute. But as we refine our attention and really, you know, are observing carefully, that number goes way up. So I'll just give you a simple example. You know, to just an ordinary audience, what do we hear? The sound of a bell. You know, it's like one experience. The sound arises and it passes. But if we're listening really carefully, how many nuances and vibrations and changes are happening within what we would call one sound? It's the same thing with the breath. How many different sensations can be felt within one in-breath or one out-breath? So on one level of magnification, an in-breath is one thing and an out-breath is another. On another level of magnification, we might notice 100 different sensations. You know, and the same thing with sensations in the body, the same thing with emotions. You know, we tend to say, oh, I'm feeling angry, I'm feeling sad. But when we're really looking and observing the nature of that experience, emotions are very complex. There's different sensations in the body and different thoughts associated with it and different kind of flavors of the mind. So there's a lot going on. It's kind of similar to At one point I was reading about the Hubble telescope, and you know, at one point they pointed at an area of the sky where they thought there was not much happening, and then they pointed the Hubble at it. I don't know, 100 million galaxies appeared. Well, it's kind of like that with our meditation. We think, oh, not much is going on. But when we refine our attention, there's... Actually, Rodney just this morning was telling me about something he had read in some science journal. This is kind of a paraphrase. That as vast as the universe is, looking outwards, if we look inwards down to the smallest elements of what happens, the very smallest, it's as vast inside as it is outside. So that's pretty amazing. You know, if we go down to like the subatomic particle level or something like that. Well, we may not get that far, but our meditation reveals a lot. And it's seeing the impermanence. Nothing lasts long enough to be held as self. We see it's just a flow of changing phenomena. What we call self is just this flow.
My question has to do with equanimity and our compassion and equanimity. I'm thinking about somebody who I care about deeply and who is has deep distress. And so I, as I listen with much compassion, and it's easy to bring forth compassion for somebody I care about deeply, and I finally understood, as I have many times, that I'm able to actually practice not fixing, you know, crying out to fix it. But there's still that, and I'm pleased about that, and I think that's the right way to go, but there's still that equanimity piece that, and it's about me too, about how it's affecting me, as well as how I affect myself. I don't know if you're saying that's enough.
Okay, so the question or the comment was about kind of the balance of compassion and equanimity in being with somebody who one cares a lot about, who's in a lot of distress, and being able to open to compassion to the distress, but how also to balance that with the equanimity of realizing that we may not be able to do anything about it. You know, even with the strong wish to do something about it, that understanding itself is the basis of equanimity. You know, that there are many things, not only in terms of interpersonal relationships, but in the world, that are outside of our control. That we don't have the ability to change even when we wish to change them. And there are a lot of things that we can do. It's really understanding that difference and seeing, you know, from a place of loving kindness, from a place of compassion and connectedness. Basically, compassion is the is expressed, or the expression of compassion is that sense of, in any situation, how can I help? You know, in a situation of suffering, how can I help? So it's very active. It's not just empathy. It's really actively asking, how can I help? Equanimity is really seeing, is there anything that I can do? You know, and sometimes there is, and sometimes there isn't. Early on, Munindraji, my first teacher, he said something which just has saved me so much distress over, you know, 40 years, 45 years. He said, you can't take responsibility for somebody else's mind. You can take responsibility for your own. And we know how difficult it is to take responsibility for our own minds. You know, that's hard enough. We can create a field of support, a field of caring, a field of compassion, but ultimately everyone is responsible for their own minds, their own hearts. You know, and I think it's that understanding which allows us to hold distressing situations both with the connectedness of compassion and with the peace of equanimity. And it sounds like that's what you're exploring and to some extent doing. So it feels like you have a good understanding of that.
Maybe as you're saying, I'm realizing I'm still struggling within myself. Still that, even though I know it as much as well as I can know it.
There's an interesting discernment to make, which is quite subtle, but it would be an interesting exploration. You know, with each of the Brahma Viharas of loving kindness and compassion and empathetic joy and equanimity, there are what are called the near enemies, you know, of states that look like it but are not it. It's very interesting. The near enemy of compassion is sorrow. You know, in the face of suffering. So that's very interesting, because when we're facing or with suffering, either our own or others, sorrow often arises, and we may often take it to be the feeling of compassion. But in sorrow, there is aversion to the suffering, you know, whether it's our own or others. So it's tinged with aversion. In compassion, it's not aversion. It's seeing the suffering with the feeling, how can I help? And even as you might just say that phrase, you know, how can I help? That's an uplifting quality of the heart. It's not an aversive one. And I really was exploring this at one point when I was doing these Brahma Viharas, these meditations intensively. You know, so I was just spending all day, every day. When I was doing the one on compassion, basically the practice is to think of someone in a situation of suffering, and it's simply repeating one phrase as we hold that image, may you be free of suffering. It's just that one line, may you be free of suffering. So you're holding the image of the situation, repeating the phrase, may you be free of suffering. And it was so interesting to watch the effect of that on the heart. It didn't go into sorrow. It went into some quality of open-heartedness that simply wanted to help. So it sounds, from what you're describing, as if the sorrow and compassion are getting mixed up a little bit, you know, and just to explore the discernment between the two. Because they're really different, but close. That's why it's so subtle.
I've always thought of the near enemy as pity, and that's different.
Yeah, that's a little different.
Yeah. That flavor of sorrow.
Yeah.
So, I've had sort of a sitting practice for about a decade where I just sit in the morning before I talk to anybody. I have appreciated how mindfulness has allowed me to see where my thoughts rest, mostly in illusion, like 99.9% of the time. But I still find that until I actually engage with another human being, there's a level of delusion that is not cut through until I'm actually like in contact with another being. Is that
okay? So the comment was that she sits every morning before she engages with anybody and notices that 99% of kind of the thoughts and mental activity is delusion, or rooted in delusion, and has experienced that it's very hard to cut through that delusion just in the sitting, but that it's actually an engagement with others that you can see it more clearly. Is that?
Yeah.
I think that's not unusual, because in the sitting practice, especially at different times, I mean, there does come a time when there's a great clarity, you know, and we really are seeing very clearly, and it's not delusional. But very often, especially in a daily practice, you know, if there's not a strong momentum of mindfulness right from the beginning, I think it's not unusual to kind of just be lost in the dreamlike quality. And when we start engaging with other people, it's like a mirror. If we're being mindful at those times of engagement, it really is like a mirror for us. You know, and it's reflecting back our own mind state. So it's not surprising that that happens. Sounds like a good thing. I guess maybe just a follow-up question. What you're describing in your sitting practice as being just thoughts of delusion, for example, what's happening at that time? Just lost in thought a lot? Or?
No, I mean, I'm growing in ability to, like, know that I'm just thinking, but there's some level of attachment to self that isn't gone until I'm, like, engaged with somebody else. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so so the comment was that in the sitting, even though maybe seeing thoughts, there's some sense of self in that that seems to be cut through in engaging. It might be interesting just to pay attention to the quality of your mind when you are engaging with others and when it feels like the sense of self is absent. So you actually become, you're highlighting for yourself what that experience of the mind is, you know, at that time, and then remember that when you're sitting, yeah, and to see if you can bring back that quality of clarity. It's a very interesting practice. It's not something we talk about that often in terms of remembering particular skillful states of mind to bring them back when we're not in them. Just as an example, and something that I've noticed and worked with, I really pay attention just in the course of my daily life when something, situation is arising where just there's a natural feeling of metta, you know, where the feeling of loving kindness is just coming for whatever reason. It's just there and feeling particularly loving or kindly. I try to mark that. You know, oh yeah, this is the feeling of metta. And so the recognition of it becomes very clear. The clearer our recognition, oh, that's this feeling, then it's easier to call it up, you know, when it's not present, because I recognize it clearly. And we can do that with any wholesome state. And that's why it's like everything becomes a whole Dharma talk. It's said that there are two causes or conditions for mindfulness to arise. One is the factor or the quality of perception. And perception means clear recognition of what's arising. So in this case, clear recognition, this is metta. Or clear recognition, this is fear, or whatever it is. We recognize something clearly. The recognition is not mindfulness. Right? It's just perceiving, oh, it's this. But then the recognition becomes the frame. It's like putting a frame around a picture. Right? We're framing it with that clear recognition and then looking directly at it. That's the mindfulness. So the clearer the perception, that then can become a cause for mindfulness to arise. And so it's clearly recognizing what the state is when you feel the sense of self is not there. You know, and then remembering. The second cause for mindfulness to arise, it said, is mindfulness itself. which suggests that we actually can build a momentum. Each moment of mindfulness makes the next moment easier. And that's why in our practice sometimes we really do feel a momentum of mindfulness building. Anyway, that's just a little sidebar. Okay, so something that I had brought up on Sunday afternoon was what I call the in order to mind. You know, where we're with an experience in order for something to happen. So, for example, we might be with a pain in order for it to go away. Or we're with an emotion in order, either for it to go away or to stay, whatever it is. I think it's helpful to understand the difference between aspiration and expectation, because sometimes these get confused. And the phrase in order to could be used for either one. So we could say, yes, I'm practicing in order to awaken. I'm practicing in order to become more loving, more compassionate. That's the in order to of aspiration, right? Where we have a value, we have a goal, we have a sense of direction. Now, this is the nature of a path that actually leads someplace. Expectation is that in order to, in the moment, that I want experience to happen this way according to my wishes in the moment. You know, it has to do, or it's tied, that in order to is tied up with wanting, greed, and aversion. So I'll give you an example of this. I can't remember whether I mentioned this on Sunday or not. But one time when I was sitting in Burma, I had been there for some time, and my whole body was just kind of like this free flow of energy. You know, it felt wonderful. It was very open. But there was one knot in my neck. Yeah, and I would be really working in order to release the knot. And I went into Saito Pandita and I was describing my experience of how just everything was open and flowing, except that I called it a block, an energy block. I thought that I was describing it objectively. I thought, yeah, the energy is open and there's a block. What he pointed out quite strongly, that just in the word block, already there was greed and aversion. What I thought was an objective description was a block, wanted to go away, wanted to be different. Instead of describing the experience simply as tightness, that was the sensation. It was just tightness. But I wasn't, in my meditation, I wasn't really being mindful of the tightness as tightness. Right? I was seeing it through the filter of the aversion and desire and wanting it to go away. So that's the kind of in order to, that's not helpful. Yeah. And so it's just to see that difference between the bigger picture aspiration and how we're relating to the moment's experience. And this in order to in the moment can get very subtle. Just another example. You know, Saito Tejaniya, the Burmese teacher, one of the techniques he suggests to use a lot is to check the attitude in the mind. with respect to whatever the experience is. And so he'll say, you know, just check the attitude, check the attitude. So at one point I was just sitting, I was just feeling my breath. You know, it was completely simple. I was just feeling in-breath, feeling out-breath. And I thought, okay, check the attitude. Simply when I had that thought in the mind, okay, check the attitude, what's the attitude in the mind? Not even asking the question for an answer. Just by asking the question, what's the attitude, I felt my mind relax back from a wanting that I didn't even know was there. Because I was just with the, you know, I wasn't trying for anything spectacular. I was just feeling my breath. But there was just this subtle, even in the feeling of the breath, kind of that subtle wanting concentration, wanting peace, wanting the next breath. And just by asking the question, I could, in the moment of asking the question, could feel that relaxation back. So it's very, sometimes it's very subtle, this leaning into experience or pushing experience away in a very subtle way. So that's the kind of in order too that's not helpful. And that question is a very useful one to bring into one's practice. You know, okay, so the question was about what has been most helpful, both in my own practice and in working with the yogis, in support of non-harming and the practice of sila. First, it is to practice sila, you know, in terms of the precepts. And I think it's really interesting. It sort of goes back to what I was saying earlier. It's very easy to settle back into a feeling that, yeah, I'm following. I'm practicing sila. You know, I'm not doing harm. And kind of just stay with that kind of general sense that we're basically good people and we're not harming. To go from that place to an active exploration, and we could take, you know, we could, in our lives, we could really focus on each precept in turn for a period of time and just explore in depth from a place of interest, not from a place of judgment at all, but just, okay, what does not killing mean? You know, what are the nuances of not killing that I can explore? You know, I'm not taking that which isn't offered. I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh has done a lot of writing and work on an elaboration of the precepts and how they can be practiced in life. One teacher said that if the practice of the precepts don't make us uncomfortable, we haven't fully explored them. You know, that just struck me as a kind of challenge, you know, and to see, just to see where we make compromises in certain ways, you know, and the trick is that it would be easy to be doing this and then go to a place of self-judgment or guilt, or, and that's really want to be careful about not going that direction. It's really about investigation and exploration. I mean, as I just mentioned earlier, the arena of speech is a great area for watching, is our speech causing harm in some way or other? Just the whole precept of not taking that which is not offered, that could open up to a whole exploration of how we relate to environmental issues. You know, so it's like kind of a huge thing. The precept about non-harming, you know, through our sexual activity, that could be a tremendous doorway beside really paying attention to our actions, you know, with respect to other people. It could be a huge doorway for understanding and looking at the nature of desire in the mind, you know, and how we can get so caught. One time Sayadaw Pandita was in Rasendra in Barry, and he was talking about this particular precept, and he did this long rap in Burmese. You know, so he was speaking 5 minutes or 10 minutes before the translator started translating. So he gave this, you know, a bit of an extended rap, and the translator translated it in 4 words. I said, "Lust cracks the brain." You know, there's so many of his talks that I really don't remember anything. I remember that. So it's just so interesting. You know, so it's not only kind of exploring the precept through our outer actions, but actually, you know, in our own minds, and to see it does. You know, it's a powerful force, the force of desire. This is not an insignificant, this is like a primal energy of life. You know, the Buddha talked about how desire is the driving force of samsara. It's what keeps this whole wheel of life and death and rebirth going. So it's not a trivial matter. So to, you know, really to begin to use the mindfulness to be watchful of how desire plays itself out, not only, you know, in our sexuality, but just desire in general in our consumer society. You know, it manifests in so many ways. So non-harming, you know, to just take a look at that and to say, okay, am I taking what isn't offered in that bigger sense, you know, or not? So there are so many dimensions to it. In terms of framing the investigation, I think it would just be interesting to frame it in terms of non-harming and maybe using the precepts, you know, as a basic guideline, but to look at it both in terms of the outer actions that we take or don't take, but also as a investigation or exploration of the mind states behind those actions. You know, and then it really becomes this inner investigation of our minds with these powerful forces. And harming, first, I just want to back up one other point here. In terms of sila, in terms of morality, it really has to do with intention. Because sometimes harm is caused not through any intention. And not even through, I mean, sometimes there's not intention, but there's delusion. You know, and that becomes why harm is caused. But sometimes things happen that is not happening through anything unskillful. So it's really looking very honestly at, again, this goes back to awareness of our motivation. If I understood the question, it's referring to something I mentioned on Sunday in terms of cultivating a wholesome state, and in this case it was generosity, and just my practicing and taking on as a practice to act, if I had a generous thought, to act on it rather than to either just let it go by or second guess myself, or and saying that I never regretted, you know, it always felt really good. So the question is, in doing that, how does one know when what reaches the point where we might regret? Is that?
Yes.
Well, maybe there is no point where you might regret, but the way to find out is to keep doing it until you do. And then to examine, if that's the case, okay, well, why is the regret happening? You know, so it just becomes a place of investigation for you. But as I said, I'm still waiting. You know, and I would recommend for practice.
And I do.
Yeah, yeah.
I learned many years ago about pushing through one's own selfishness. Uh-huh.
I understand a little better. What I was suggesting is a little different than what you just described, because what you described was a more active sense of extending your limits and just giving. I think Mother Teresa, she expressed it once, give until it hurts. You know, and so that's one way of undertaking that practice. What I was suggesting was something a little different than that, and it was more just responding to those thoughts that came up in my mind. I wasn't trying to push myself in a particular direction, but rather, if the generous impulse came, to act on it. So there's a different flavor to that. In what you were suggesting, I think care is needed that you include yourself in beings that you're caring for. Because in the way you described it, you could push to being generous at the expense, perhaps, of really caring for yourself as well. You know, and in some way that doesn't sound so healthy. But the two practices are somewhat different.
Yeah.
Okay, so the question was about how to integrate different parts of one's experience that had been felt or experienced as being unacceptable, for example, anger, you know, and learning to integrate these emotions or these parts of experience into ourselves. So there are two different elements here. And we'll take anger as an example, but it could be any emotion. You know, it could be fear, it could be unworthiness, it could be envy, jealousy, whatever. It's actually amazing how long the list is of afflictive emotions. There's a difference between acceptance of the fact that something is there and identification with it. So in the awareness, back up a minute. Years ago, this must go back 35 years or so, I was teaching a retreat at a Trappist monastery in Snowmass, Colorado. And this was, obviously it was quite a liberal group because they invited me to come, you know, as a Buddhist teacher. But they had just been doing some workshops with, I don't know who it was with exactly, but they had just come off this workshop that had been sort of saying, you know, well, honor your anger. And it was very interesting to me, you know, given that the Buddha talked about anger being an unwholesome mind state. And so when I was listening to them, and there was something of value, you know, that they had gotten from this, but as I was listening, I really began to see the difference between honoring the anger and honoring the fact that anger is present. You know, because anger is an unwholesome mind state. But that doesn't mean that we should have aversion towards it, because that's just more ill will. That's just compounding it. So we can honor the fact of what our experience is in the moment, and that means acceptance. You know, and so we are actually feeling it and investigating it. You know, what is the nature of anger? What does it feel like? That's very different than, yeah, I'm angry and I should be angry and I'm going to act out this anger. Those are two very different approaches. And so just in yourself, as these feelings come up, there's a magic mantra. Actually, this mantra has served me really well. I was working with it with fear, but it applies to all of these afflictive emotions. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. Just let me feel it. It's okay. And it was particularly hard with fear because it's very unpleasant. You know, it's not a pleasant emotion. And the tendency for a long time was to see it, but wanting it to go away, practicing in order for it to go away. That's just the flip side of identifying with it and acting on it. And so it's finding that place in yourself. It's okay. It's okay to feel it. And in that acceptance of it, you're actually allowing the space for it to wash through. So you're not pushing it away, and you're not identified with it. And that takes practice. You know? But it's very freeing. Just imagine a mind, a heart, that was open to whatever emotions, whatever they were, you know, anger, fear, sadness, love, generosity, compassion, envy, jealousy. We're just open to the arising of whatever it is with interest, right? And mindfulness. So we're really seeing, we're paying attention, we're open, and in that openness, having the discernment to understand is this a skillful state that I should cultivate? Is it an unskillful state that I should let wash through? You know, so it's not just that we're kind of falling into emotional turmoil in our practice of acceptance. We practice it and then use the acceptance as a platform for discernment. But it's, and what you described is, it's really kind of a beautiful process of learning not to be afraid to feel different emotions. You know, so we're just open to the whole range of our experience, but with discernment. And as Trungpa Rinpoche would often say in his teachings, good luck. It's challenging, you know. I was talking about on Sunday, but I think, you know, we have a comfort zone and then we get to the edge of our comfort zone. And mostly we just pull back to be comfortable. But being at the edge of our comfort zone is exactly where our practice wants to be. You know, okay, can I open to that? Can I open to that? Can I open to that? Whether it's physical discomfort or mental, emotional discomfort. Okay, Rodney's giving me the hook. Thank you so much.